My name is Yana Owens, and I'm interviewing John B. Pete Frazier via Skype to his home phone in Hammond, Louisiana, on Thursday, March the 8th, 2012. Pete Frazier graduated from the NCSU School, now College of Design, in 1954. Since then, he has had a long career as a landscape architect, planner, educator, and author. His projects have been located in diverse environmentally and ethnically separate regions of the globe, from the Middle East to South America to the U.S. Gulf and Caribbean. A book he authored with Richard J. Julian in 1967 called Your Future in Landscape Architecture is still valuable reading. So, Pete?
Yes, I appreciate that.
Are you ready for some questions?
Surely.
Okay, tell me a little bit about where you grew up.
I was one of those late bloomers. I didn't really grow up until I met Lewis Clark in 1952. But I was one of those war babies, you might say. All of the men went to the Second War, so we had, my colleagues and I, had to fit the male figure and take on the responsibilities. This was during the closing days, the waning days of the Second War.
And you were in North Carolina during that time?
Correct. I'm a Westerner North Carolinian, you might say. In between the Piedmont section, in between the mountains and the coastal plain.
Right. What county were you, did you grow up in?
The county Cleveland, town Shelby.
Ah, so you are from up in the mountain area then.
Correct.
So what year did you graduate from high school?
I think they were glad to get rid of me, but that was
Why is that?
49. And so we picked up on the 49ers cliche, mm-hmm. and it's a pretty active alumni group, I say. It's still active. We usually have hit the high points, 10, 20s, and we just got through the 60th, I think, alumni meeting.
Goodness. Well, I understand when you graduated from high school, you had a choice between attending Stetson College in DeLand, Florida, and NC State. Tell me how you went about making a choice between those two institutions.
Well, two reasons. One, I was very much into music as I entered the waning years of my high school, and had a musical scholarship offered in Stetson. My band teacher was an alumna of that institution, so she helped me to get a scholarship. The other, most of my family all went the route of North Carolina State, being an A&M university at that time.
Mm-hmm.
My father was a land surveyor and a civil engineer, as well as his brother. And so most of the family went to NC State, and I opted to do the same.
Well, that's following the family tradition, right?
Correct.
And what year did you come to Raleigh?
Seems to me the fall of 49. I hopped straight from high school into an engineering curricula, and it didn't last very long. I turned one semester, or we were on at that time the quarter system, one quarter in ceramic engineering, and quickly went into landscape architecture.
Well, what was your thinking about going in? How did you go from music to ceramic engineering?
Just misled advice by my father.
Oh, okay.
It happened to be a prime economic sustenance of the small town in Union County where my mother was born and raised. And they made bricks and tiles and pavers. So I thought I had had a chance at it, but the chemistry that's required to make those items turned me off in a hurry.
I can understand that. I can understand that. So when you decided to switch schools, that would have been, was that like, if you're on the quarter, and I have to rethink, you were in the quarter system, so this was still the what we would call now the fall of 49 is when you decided to switch schools, right?
Right. So I had to go to summer school to make up for being in the wrong field.
I have a feeling you had to meet with Dean Henry Kampfner about the switch, did you?
Come again?
Whenever you decided to switch schools from engineering to design school, did you have to meet with Dean Henry Kampfner?
Oh, correct. That was very close to his first few years of being the dean. So I was lucky in that landscape architecture, most of the curriculum classes were on the same floor as the dean's office, so we got to see more of the dean than the architecture students.
What was he like?
Not a very jovial type, more serious. And when he said yes, he meant yes. When he said no, he meant no.
Right. Well, you got there in the infancy of the school design for sure, because it was actually just founded in 48. So, I mean, we're looking at you're one of the first people in this whole program. So, so you're having to make up classes from being in engineering to changing over to design. So, what courses did you take to finish out your first full year?
Well, I guess going to summer school helped, because we had a one-to-one relationship with one of the talented artists of the School of Design, Manuel Bromberg, and he taught me more of the art involved in landscape architecture than the engineering part, that is making the art work.
Right. So you were taking courses with Bromberg then?
Righto.
Do you remember was it drawing classes, or what were the classes like?
They started with the basics. You pick up a pencil, and it's got a point or a chisel, and depending how you put the pencil to the paper, you can make a flat, distinct, dark, rather boisterous mark, or if it's got a sharp point, it'll be timid. And you can do in those choices, timid or boisterous, you can put together pictures of people, that is, figure drawing,
right,
or lettering, making calligraphic choices. So I got interested in calligraphy and figure drawing and abstract drawing.
Well, from the work that I've seen of yours, you turned out to be quite an artist, so congratulations to Bromberg on that one, right?
Correct, and I think he probably taught summer school to help his pocketbook more than anything else, but he taught several years in the summer session, mm-hmm. and I think I had him more than once, and had a good rapport with him. We both spoke the same language.
Uh-huh. What was he like as a person?
Who?
Bromberg.
Very vociferous. That is, he used the language to convey his ideas, and he got the point across very quickly.
Uh-huh.
Outspoken, never forcefully, but starting with the reason that you touched the pencil to the paper, and then letting you decide what pressure you would use.
Right.
It goes back to basics.
Right. Well, about the this time when you were in summer school, they were probably, I'm guessing, starting the construction on the new college union, right?
It was a little further down the line.
And fill me in a little bit on this one, is that Bromberg started designing a mural for that, for one of the walls in the College Union, right?
Correct.
Do you remember anything about him designing that mural, or any? Was he working on it where people could see him working on it?
Oh, yes. It was quite, I guess, a major step in the field of art to have that kind of mural. They traditionally had more realistic paintings and things like that, but Manuel had most of the artwork with a spatula, which is like a plumber's wall finisher's trowel. And was rough and spontaneous,
mm-hmm.
and it was full scale, stand up, floor to ceiling, and I suppose it's still there. I'm not
yes,
sure.
it is, and we've got there's been quite a bit of interest in it because there's some things about it we've forgotten, so that's why I remembered that you had said that at one time. And elsewhere that you had taken some classes with him. So he actually put the plaster on the wall himself?
No, but Bromberg had a lot of students helping him and paying them for their help.
Really? I know that one corner of the mural is signed by Ligon Flynn. Do you remember Ligon Flynn?
Who?
Ligon Flynn.
Oh, yes, yes. He and I were very tight buddies. I think he dropped out in order to make a little money, and he worked full-time on the mural.
Uh-huh. Well, it's still there, and we're still enjoying it, so it was quite a feat. Okay, I want to go back to when you switched from engineering to school design, and what were you hearing or seeing, or what led you to decide on majoring in landscape architecture?
Well, there again, my father had something to do with it, not only paying the tuition, but he worked for, I guess, 2 or 3 years with a well-known landscape architect out of Atlanta doing city park and golf course. And
do you remember who that was?
No, I don't.
It wouldn't have been Willard Byrd, would it?
May have been, but my father wound up doing most of the design work. But I remember going down on the train from Shelby to Atlanta to meet with the landscape architect and returning the same day.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a logical choice. So I tried it and found it to be my sense of scale, that is larger than doing brick and mortar design, but it involved landscapes which might be 100 acres or more.
So you found that intriguing. Well, who were some of the landscape architecture students that were there when you were there?
First, we had a carryover from the Department of Horticulture and the School of Agriculture. And they were put in the School of Design. And
that was what Camp Hefner's new program was about, right?
Right, and this was early 50s, and several of them I don't guess I ever met, but I knew them by their reputation. Georgie Patton from Philadelphia, and Dick Godwin, I guess.
Dick Bell.
And yeah, Dick Bell. And then other carryovers, Ely from Louisville, Kentucky, I guess, and, several others, Bob Horn, and
the Coulter brothers,
right?
And how about John, is it Lippard? John Lippard?
Oh, yes. He was the one that I wound up working with over the summer vacation period. But he brought one of his commissions in to give to the students, Horn of the West Amphitheater. In Boone, North Carolina.
Oh, really?
And ran it as a student program, and actually paid all of the expenses that the students. It was a good working experience.
Wow.
So Lippard was a pretty famous entrepreneur, you might say, of the day.
Right. Oh, I thought of one more person, Jim Godwin.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. I don't think I've ever met him. I just remember that they were the graduates to whom we could work during our summer vacations. Very seldom did we see them actually on site, that is, in the architecture building.
Right. Well, during the first 2 years of the program, landscape architecture and architecture students took the same courses. Tell me about some of your architecture professors.
It was an excellent introduction to the art and science of architecture, which later became art and science of landscape architecture. And Cecil Elliott was one of the early instructors, and some architect that finally put his roots down in Philadelphia.
George Qualls.
I'm sorry?
George Qualls?
Yes. And then George Matsumoto.
What was George like?
He was handling most of the third-year students, and that was my last step before actually going into landscape architect architectural classes up on the third floor of the School of Design building.
Let's see, we had Willie Bumgarner taught the history of architecture. What do you remember about Willie?
Who?
Willie Bumgarten.
He taught the history of architecture, and I remember he used to put the class to sleep because it was scheduled right after lunch period at 1 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to wake up the projectionist one day. They were both called Willie. And in his Belgian accent, he called him Willie, Willie. Then wake up, Willie. But we just kind of tripped the stool that Willie was sitting on, and he woke up in a hurry.
Let's see. For a required course called Descriptive Drawing, you had Duncan Stewart. What was Duncan Stewart like, and what was this course about?
Well, it's really descriptive drawing means painting and conceptual art as well. And so we handled many different disciplines rolled into one, from silk screens to lithographs, to oils and watercolors.
Good heavens.
And then pen and ink. We actually took the ink, ground it, and then dipped it, diluted it from black to a pale gray, in about 7 different gradations, and use like the old masters, and a wash and highlight.
Wow.
With the ink quill nibbed drawings, I guess.
Right.
It was an experience. I still remember it.
I guess so. As making your own materials to use, that's pretty intense. Well, let's see here. Coming through the program, you and Ben Geary were the entire class of 1954. Tell me about Ben Geary.
I don't have too many good words to say about Ben. He was a little hungry for his education to get behind him and go into the field. So he opted to drop out in the fourth year and might have been more relocation, because he was married, I believe, at that time. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Relocation to the Boston area. And he finished his education at Harvard. So he didn't get an undergraduate degree, but he got a master's degree.
Wow. Well, does that mean that you were the entire class of 1954?
I wouldn't like to advertise it, but I had the highest grades and also the lowest grades of anyone in the fifth year class.
Oh. There were 3 full-time landscape architecture faculty members at the time, and let's see, the head of the department was old-timer Morley Williams, and then there was Larry Enerson, and Gil Thurlow were the other 2. Tell me some things about these guys.
I'd say we had a split down the middle between the traditional teaching of landscape architecture, more in the traditional gardenesque manner,
mm-hmm.
with alleys and classical sculptures and the garden park environment. with Morley Williams being the head of the department at that time. Enerson was an architect by training as well as a landscape architect, and he gave us many of the tools that we could use, taught us lettering and draftsmanship and that, and was on the modernistic end of it. Gil Thurlow was a plantsman and used plant material and more or less specialized in planting design. That left a big hole in the middle, which Lewis Clark, a young gentleman from Harvard, filled, and that's who we're talking about, I suppose.
Yeah, we're getting to that we're to that point. Lewis Clark joined the faculty in the fall of 1952. Tell me about your first meeting.
We separated from architecture in the third year, the third quarter of the third year, I suppose. So I went from Matsumoto in architecture to the first meeting of, with Lewis Clark, I suppose. And it was an enlightenment because we had never been exposed to anything other than what we saw in Sunset Magazine on the West Coast, the gardens of Tommy Church and Gary Ekbo, and the gardens on the East Coast with James Rose, and of course Frederick Law Olmsted in Central Park that came in the magazine Southern Living out of Atlanta. So they called us posy planters because the architects did. When I say they called us posy planters because of our attention to gardenesque design, more details and more backyard swimming pool decks and outdoor furniture of a almost one-to-one scale. And somewhere along the line we forgot what Olmsted had set forth in the park movement of Central Park in New York City, which incidentally my daughter lives within walking distance of Central Park. In the last 25 years she's been there, but she doesn't even know how to spell Olmsted.
Oh my.
He also was the landscape architect for Biltmore Mansion outside of the city of Asheville.
Right. So you have this faculty that's kind of split down the middle, and you have this young guy come in from Harvard. And so what started happening then?
We found the key between Olmsted's grandiose parks and detailed Tommy Church residential architecture. And the key was just trying to define the difference between the residential and the national park scale involved several steps, and to maybe golf course architecture, city parks, state wildlife and fisheries, more naturalistic management to regional parks like Yellowstone and so forth that we find on the national scale.
Right.
He gave us an introduction to the logic involved in jumping from one scale to another. And it coincided with the architectural renegade at the same time, Book Minister Fuller, who always said, see your landscapes one scale larger than you're working at, so that you know the pieces will fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. That you won't alienate the larger picture from the smaller picture, but it's all one. Well, that's it. As an introduction, Lewis Clark married the architectural philosophy of Bucky Fuller with the artistic endeavors of Garrett Ekbo, Bob Royston, Tommy Church, Lawrence Halpern, Brenda Colvin, all of the other practitioners. You have to remember it was almost maybe 10 landscape architects in the world that had caught our attention, only because the popular magazines picked them up and they ran articles. And we suddenly wondered how we fitted amongst the different walking into Central Park in New York, and foreclosure, you know, a little patio in a house, or even a planting box.
Right. So it was a matter of adjusting to your thinking and your kind of like insights into a site based on first of all on scale, right?
Yeah, you put it admirably there. It had a logic. Each endeavor that we might embark upon had its own set of determinants. Maybe one would be in a swamp environment, so water and rocks and the source of the water and the drainage off of the site were determinants. Which we could exploit or try to contain it. Excuse me. But
Go ahead.
Well, each of those scales had their own set of criteria, and it told us that design was one part logic and mathematical, and one part artistic, involved the creative mind.
Right.
So we married the two, but we couldn't make one work without the other. Mm-hmm. In other words, you do the super creative design, but you have to build it as well. So to interpret that for the contractor, you need to put it into mathematics. that is working drawings and construction documents.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not all one or the other, but it's a marriage between the creativity that we learn from the Bombergs and the Duncan Stewarts and the mathematicians in construction,
mm-hmm.
and also dealing with the horticultural aspects of the business as well.
Right. Now you guys also started using a data collection method that was a bit inventive. So, do you remember what Lewis was teaching you about that?
We were exposed. Only one way to describe it, jumping from the pot into the frying pan. He had a system laid out for us of determining the form that a design would take based on the determinants of vegetation, topsoil, geology, climate, the determinants of climate, regions of warm and temperate and tropical, and then the techniques of transposing these, let's say putting a railroad through Pullman Park, example, putting a superhighway through, and where does the highway stop and the natural environment take over, and how important each aspect of these might be.
Mm-hmm.
So we suddenly saw, as we hit the frying pan, that all design is logical. You take the determinants based upon what's there, and the ideas which you might have as a creative person to express the cultural attitudes of people, mm-hmm. the transportation, all of this pot pourri that is going to use that land.
Right.
And it's very logical then. You can build here, but you can't build there.
Right. And then what you used to visually display this kinds of determinants, you started calling it the overlay system, right?
Right. Now, I became aware of that not only by moving in so many different climates, the climatic environment, from North Carolina to Boston to Michigan and then Puerto Rico, and from Puerto Rico to Louisiana, where
right.
I am now, about as far north as I want to go. But each of these, especially the areas that are predominantly natural, such as Louisiana, you've got water as a determinant primarily coming in, going out, the Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
or the Gulf, and it has very little tide, but it has some salinity. It has a strong separation between freshwater, levees, backwater, swamp, freshwater, swamp,
mm-hmm.
marsh, at Saline and the Gulf.
And these would be things that back when you were studying with Lewis, that that landscape architects weren't necessarily taking into consideration in their designs. Is that right?
Correct.
Well, do you recall any of the projects you worked on as a student?
Yes. That from the frying pan back into the pot.
Right.
We learned that the pot consists of subsurface geology, surface geology, that is runoff and drainage, and vegetation existing, and the direction that the vegetation appears to be in terms of ecology, that is, it's tending to grow into a mature pine forest, but it can't quite make it there because of urbanization on the other end creeping in and cutting down the pine trees. So what design decisions we would develop from looking at the land would sustain the tendency, that is, the ecology, the natural inclination of the landscape, and marry it with the urbanization that's creeping on the other side.
Right.
So that you have a self-sustaining landscape.
Yes. Now, you guys put these principles to practical use, I think, when you when the students did some work on Pullen Park before it was renovated, right?
Correct. And that, we took our ideas, put them on paper, ran blue line print, slapped the back of the blue line prints with rubber cement, glued the rubber cement to an illustration board, and made an exhibit. Now, instead of the maps that we drew being wadded up because of the rubber cement, we had to separate the illustration board, which is the media for presenting the exhibit, from being just a mass of glue. We would put what we call trash paper down with one thin line left open and exposed to the glue, coating both surfaces. As soon as that glue touched, it would be fast. So we would slowly pull out the non-glue guide paper.
Right.
And get the air bubbles out, and we made exhibit material, which otherwise nothing but maps.
Right.
And we had, gosh, 30 or 40 or more, 30 by 40 size, inches, 30 by 40 inches in illustration exhibit material that we put in the hallway of the School of Design building. And we could step back and see what we had done, and overlaying each of these sheets, we began to see where we could change it and where we must adhere to the forces of nature.
Right. So you guys mapped out like the soils and the subsurface geology and existing structures and bubble diagrams of possible designs, And then from that you came up with conclusions on what would and would not work. Is that right?
Correct. Then the architects who wore their egos on their coat sleeves, we had a discipline antagonism going back and forth. They called us posy planters.
Right.
And we called them something that I couldn't say on the telephone.
Okay.
They were a little egocentric.
Yeah.
And they looked clandestinely towards landscape architects, not with a lot of pride. But we showed them a different logic where we could determine where the buildings could go.
Right.
And where the buildings could not go, because you can't support a building on swamp.
Right.
And you can support it on stone, but you can't regrade where the stone outcroppings are.
Mm-hmm.
You have to work around the outcroppings. So you take your hand left and spread your digits, and take your right hand and place them in between the digits, so you get two hands and a fist as one.
Right.
The digits of the fingers are the determinants of where you can build and where you cannot build.
Mm-hmm.
And the fist is how the architecture can fit into the spaces allowed by nature.
Mm-hmm.
So we showed our compatriots the architectural end of the School of Design,
mm-hmm.
that we had a system too.
Right.
As they used structures, mathematics to determine how you could build, we did the same.
Mm-hmm. Now this was an innovation, right?
Correct. More or less unheard of that ecology could be to us what statics and strength of materials were,
mm-hmm.
to the architectural end of the School of Design.
And this is what Lewis brought with him from England, is that right?
Yes, and some he invented with his own sense of creativity. Oh, he brought a little bit of the what I say Brenda Colvin, whom I met at the University of Georgia
one
time, and it was a practice in England of using every square inch because it was an island.
Mm-hmm.
I practiced on an island too in Puerto Rico, and the natural determinants had to be wisely used. You couldn't haphazardly come and build without a master plan.
Right. So it's something that we continue to use even today, right?
Yes, not as wisely, though. The space program, when you get up that high, you can see that there's the buildable and the non-buildable, pretty obvious.
Uh-huh.
Fairly obviously where the forest ends and
right.
where the cities begin and how the cities tend to be very wasteful.
Well, there was it was quite an experience, it sounds like, and I'm thinking in addition to the school design instructors, you were also exposed to an amazing list of visiting professionals and crits. And I'm just going to name a few that I know were that visited when you were there. Was Lewis Mumford, Mies van der Rohe, Frank Lloyd Wright, Roberto Burley Marx, Garrick Ekbo, Bob Royston, and Buckminster Fuller. I was wondering, you're probably one of the last living people that was there with the Frank Lloyd Wright visit in May of 1950. And I was wondering if you could tell me about when he was introduced by Camp Hefner, and I thought it was Reynolds, but I think that some people say it was in the old chapel there was a meeting, and Wright walked off the stage. What was that story about?
Wright had a temperamental side to him. He epitomized the egotistical architect by saying, he really was more of a landscape architect than an architect. His love of nature and the forms which his heart architecture took was copied more or less by the rules of nature and nuclear cellular kind of design that fitted together into the landscape without destroying the landscape, very much involved in natural architecture, you might say. He looked about the old lecture hall which he was on the stage and just didn't say a word. He just looked at it and walked out the front door.
Was it the building that disturbed him?
And he was supposed to give a lecture. And all of the students started following him like a herd of cattle. And I was lucky enough to be within about 4 feet of him.
Really?
And he would stop underneath the shade of a tree and feel the bark and the leaves and the color of the leaves. And
right. Now, was this going out of Brooks Hall, or?
I guess that, I've forgotten the name of it, but he took, like a Pied Piper, all of the audience with him right out of with leaving Neen Camp Hefner on the stage alone.
Oh, really?
And walked about the campus, just stopping ever so often and emphasizing the view, emphasizing the shade and the sun and the trees and the size of the trees. And
did you go up by Holiday Hall by chance?
You got me. I don't remember it.
The old administration building or anything?
Oh, yes. Is that where the School of Design is located now?
It's in what they call Brooks Hall now. And then, of course, it has a new building on the back, too. But I was just, just for my own curiosity, I just was wondering where the trees, that you stopped at. Because we do have some photographs of him sitting with students underneath some trees. And I'm going to go back and look at that picture a little more closely and see if I can see your face in there.
Have been right about where the bell tower was.
Okay. Like across from Pullen Park or right in that area?
Correct.
Or not Pullen, but Theater in the Park, I guess. Oh, that was the Armory then. It was called the Armory. Across. Okay.
Well, then he gave us a very good lecture.
What did he lecture about? Do you remember anything he said specifically?
No questions from the floor. He did all of the talking.
Uh-huh.
And he was his exemplary self. He's all ego. And
did he have a brusque voice, or what kind of voice did he have?
Gosh, you got me. He probably gravelly.
Uh-huh.
But there, he certainly got your attention.
Really? Well, the other person I was going to ask you about is Lewis Mumford. How did Raleigh react to Lewis Mumford's visits?
Lewis was probably Dean Camp Eppner's favorite.
Really?
He,
do you know why that he was his favorite?
More the sociopolitical end of the design spectrum, but the he didn't last very long. The his political philosophy didn't go for that particular era of the socio-political economic determinism, you might say.
How is it different? Are you
it's
talking about like for Raleigh's
of being a communist
in southern segregated Raleigh, North Carolina?
So one of the regular entrepreneurs was Bucky Fuller.
Uh-huh.
He came back year after year after year after year, and had a student, architectural, most of the architectural audience were fascinated with him.
Mm-hmm.
But he had one thing, is a geodesic dome. I now live in a geodesic dome. So I appreciate
I think you have 7 of them connected together, don't you?
I'm sorry?
You have 7 of them connected together, is that correct?
Yes, we have. We live in 3 hooked together with a common space.
Uh-huh.
And that's where I'm speaking now. I have a 26-foot high ceiling.
Uh-huh.
And probably about 8,000 square feet.
Wow. So you guys actually called Fuller. You actually called him Bucky, right? Everybody called him that?
Yes. And he was very famous for giving 4-hour stand-up lectures.
Oh, my gosh.
And you get into talking, and he went everywhere. He claimed that there'd be no more war because in the 50s we would have more than 51% of the housing deficit solved by using his geodesic system.
Mm-hmm.
We would have no housing shortage, but we would have no need for war. We could concentrate on industrial housing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, right, he had his disciples and was very, very popular on campus.
Mm-hmm. Now, was Jim Fitzgibbon there while you were there and working with Bucky Fuller?
Right.
Jim Fitzgibbon?
Who?
Jim Fitzgibbon. Was he working with Bucky Fuller at that time?
Oh, yes. He opened his first commercial enterprise and called Geodesics Incorporated. Not far from the campus, as a matter of fact.
No
Duncan
kidding.
Spear was, I think, the president of the corporation. Duncan, in those days, did computer math on his slide room. And he was a mathematician as well as an artist. So he and Bucky got along very well. And James Fitzgibbons joined them. Fitzgibbons was the artistic end of it, and Duncan was the mathematician end of it.
So this is all in the air around you as you're studying, all of this kind of, at that time, I wouldn't guess you wouldn't call it space age, but certainly advanced thinking into the future is just all around you. It just seems like you couldn't help but be influenced by it.
Very much so. And being a sole senior in my fifth year, I had the personal attention of Lewis Clark. And it was my job to pick his brain.
What did you find out?
I found out that there's the buildable and the unbuildable. The unbuildable is sacrosanct. You cannot touch it. The buildable, you can play around with it, but forever allow it to take its... they call it propensity. It's how can you interpret that word? Propensity is the way things tend to gravitate towards stability. You're always in search of stability, but you never get to it.
I think they call that entropy these days, don't they?
Yes, well, Lewis drew a picture of a stick man standing up. Then he drew a picture of a stick man laying on the ground. And he said, what's the difference? And I said, well, one is life and one is death. So he said, you can change what you can change, but be ever cognizant of what you're changing and give nature the credit line. He would use words that the students could understand. And wasn't wound up as Morley Williamson, I guess it was, our first head of the first head of the landscape architecture department, who took us around us, visit all of the classical gardens of the time, where man impregnated the shaping of the landscape. He said, let it develop in its own terms, and that's what he meant, give nature the credit line.
That's Lewis saying that.
Lewis Clark. Well, I'm getting kind of far afield.
No, that's okay. I was gonna, I was gonna ask you about the West Coast modernist style versus the East Coast traditional style, but I think we mentioned that already. So, let's see here. In Lewis Clark's collection of faculty papers that we have now in the archives at Special Collections, we have a cover you designed and printed for copies of Burley Marx's lecture. And I heard you say when you were taking a class with Bromberg that you were exposed to silk screening, and I think these covers have been silk screened. Do you remember doing those?
Yes. You know, I don't have a copy of my own work.
Really? I hear that a lot. Well, anyway, you and several students got involved in a Burley Marx field trip to Washington, D.C. I'd love for you to tell me about that adventure.
That was fun. I was an intern with the Department of Interior, National Capitol Park, and we were responsible for all of the parks in the D.C. and the district. And Rock Creek Park was one of them, and it was a short summer's internship, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. I got to know every square inch of the district, including the responsibilities of National Capitol Park. The Rock Creek is one of the major spines that threads its way up north out of the district.
Right.
And it has Rock Creek. That's where it gets its name. Free-flowing stream. And it has a road that fords the creek. And so when we took the students, and me being one of the students, to Rock Creek Park, we forded the creek. And I suddenly realized that's nature. we're getting our tires wet.
You drove through Rock Creek?
Right. We went right through the creek. Up to the other side of the park.
Okay.
And it was meant to be.
But
it was naturally indistinguishable.
Right.
So that was when Roberto Burley Marx had made his first trip to the United States to open an exhibition at the Brazilian embassy in the district, Washington, D.C. And we were his guests for dinner. And he came from a talented family. His brother was a concert master in Philadelphia for the Philadelphia Symphony Orchestra.
I didn't know that.
Yes, it's a very, very talented family. But Louis was one of our chaperones, you might say.
Oh, really?
There
wasn't a lot of difference in ages, I understand, between the students and Louis, so I have trouble at this point thinking of him as your chaperone.
The age difference between Louis and myself is only about 5 years,
right.
So you can see that we thought of him more as one of us. Than the more elderly professorial picture.
Right. Okay, so you got him as a chaperone going to have dinner with Burley Marx in Washington, D.C., and then what happened?
Say that again.
Louis is one of your chaperones, and you're in D.C. having dinner with Burley Marx, so what happened then?
Oh, he pulled out a wad of money and he was going to pay for our dinner. And his brother said, you're not supposed to do that in an American restaurant. You'll probably get mugged or held up or burglarized. But Louis, we thought was more, was in those, since we had become accustomed to his British accent, we knew and married together Americanization of some landscape terms we were popular in England, an American prototype and that we used in everyday English. So we looked at him more as one of us, and we could understand him, and we saw the logic that he had demonstrated. Mm-hmm. It took all the mystery away from landscape architecture and put it in the discipline of science and art. Mm-hmm. And we felt much more confident.
Well, it sounds like you guys had tools that you used to kind of illustrate things. And one item that I've come across a couple of times is something that's called the model box. Do you remember the model box?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I don't know who should be given the credit line, Lewis or Bob Royston. The Royston, they probably collaborated on it, one with the other.
Right.
Bob was one of these West Coast landscape architects with whom I affectionately had a lot of dealings with on a professional level.
Oh, good.
And he and I joint ventured on several things that didn't materialize, but we at least put our heads in the ring.
Right.
And considered him a close friend.
Oh, that's nice.
And he and Lewis engineered the model box, which is a box that had a circular movable platform and slits cut on all four sides that represent the scale of the circular movement that we could set up designs and peek through the slits, and it was supposed to be about the same as real life experience. And say a quarter scale or eighth scale or something like that.
So you'd pick your scale and then build a model to that scale of your design?
And put the scaled model inside the model box, and four sides, four different people could look at the same time and see the designs and how they would be appear in the real landscape.
So it was like an optical illusion kind of thing that puts you into the design itself?
There you go.
Ah, okay. Very interesting.
It, as I said at one time in our correspondence, I thought the professors got more out of it than the students.
Well, it sounds like you all had fun. It really does. I want to ask you about an unfortunate incident. Architect Matthew Nowitzki died in a plane crash around midnight on the 30th of August or the 1st of September 1950. Do you have any impressions from that event that you'd like to share?
Not much. 50s. Would be the beginning of my exposure to architect, landscape architect, school of design. Just getting my whiskers wet,
right.
Just beginning, and I never knew Matthew but other than reputation.
Uh-huh.
My more or less stepfather was Dr. Dorton, from the hometown, and he also was the client for the Raleigh State Fair. He was the entrepreneur of the State Fair and
right.
Hired Nowitzki to do the arena.
So you're literally your stepfather was Dr. Dorton?
Yes, he was very close personal friend, Dr. Dorton.
Uh-huh.
But later on, after Matthew died, I think Eduardo Catalano adapted the arena to his own picture of the integration of structures and architecture. The hyperbolic paraboloid.
Right.
And that's where it went. And to this day, you can still hear the squeaking and the singing of the cables that are strung in the roof of that. Acoustically, it didn't work very well.
It's a very beloved building. It really is. Dorton Arena. They call it Dorton Arena now.
Correct.
For the for Dorton Arena.
The arena fulfilled Eduardo Catalano's desires, but as a building, probably doesn't work too well.
Really? Well, let's see now. I'm thinking the Nowitzki's design was for the arena, and then Catalano designed it's called a Catalano roof these days, but I'm hearing you say that Catalano drew on some of Nowitzki's structural
probably not.
Ideas.
My mind's a little hazy in the
50s. Right.
But all I remember is the Catalano design.
Okay, well, after you graduated from State, what did you do?
I faced a hard and cruel world of trying to make a buck. I suddenly realized it's not all peaches and cream. I did immediately have to serve my country. I was called into the Army. And luckily, out of the whole division, I was the singular person that was stationed in Japan. Everybody else was shipped to Korea.
Mm-hmm.
I served as the only landscape architect in the 1st Cavalry Division, and I had the island of Japan, Honshu, as my teacher as well.
No
with
kidding.
The Japanese garden.
Right.
And I took every chance I could to get the most of it, and I traveled during my leave. So I lived in Japan for 2 years, and my daughter, her first language was Japanese.
Wow.
It whetted her appetite for learning other languages. And she's bilingual in 3 different languages now.
Gracious. Well, and, so when...
After I returned to the States, again, my port of call was Sacramento, and I met Bob Royston again after I graduated, after that 2-year lapse.
Right.
And we became truly hard and fast friends. Then I went to Harvard, got my master's and my first real live teaching job, where I had a dollar coming in on my own.
Where were you teaching?
Michigan State University.
Ah.
So I taught there until I could not take the snow. Started in Thanksgiving and stayed on the ground until Easter. I took a radical approach and went to the tropics and landed in Puerto Rico.
Ooh, how nice.
And
now
at
this time,
years.
You did 10 years. Is that where your practice was called Environmental Design Associates?
Correct. I would still be there today if I could make a living down there.
Yeah.
But it gave me a new internationalism. That is, I had to learn another language, Spanish.
Right.
We were in the metric system instead of the English feet and inches.
Uh-oh.
5 feet outside of the building line, it was metric. 5 feet into the building, it was feet and inches.
Oh, no. Who were your partners?
Huh?
Who were your partners?
I met them when I took my first job with an architectural firm, Sergeant Webster, Crenshaw, and Folly. We called them We the People. And my Augustine Costa, C-O-S-T-A, was he and I decided to go into partnership and open an office together. Then later on, architect partner joined us, Monhill, it's spelled like Angel, Angel Caban. We pronounced it Angel Caban. So the three of us kept a pretty active office, and it was a housing boom at the time. I just happened to land in Puerto Rico with a housing deficit,
mm-hmm.
and it was contractors' haven. We had more jobs than we could execute.
Well, about what year was that?
You got me the early 60s to the 70s, I guess.
Uh-huh.
No, the early 60s to 1969.
Uh-huh.
I moved to the States again in 70.
Uh-huh.
Going back into teaching at Louisiana State University.
Now, you were there a long time, right?
Yes, until now. And I retired as I joined the teaching profession in the School of Design at Louisiana State University on the condition that I was allowed to have a part-time office and practice, full-time practice. So I had to juggle around full-time load teaching as well as full-time load practicing.
My gosh.
Working about 60 to 80 hours a week.
I can imagine.
And traveling. Picked up a lot of foreign work by my knowledge of Spanish, and a couple of colleagues that threw work our way from Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
The classmates of mine at Harvard who opened professional office in Washington called Coffin and Coffin, and also they had the journal International Institute of Site Planning.
Ah, okay.
Institute of Site Planning has been published 50 years until Beatrice Coffin decided to retire,
mm-hmm.
and Larry Coffin threw much of his work that he couldn't execute my way. So I picked up a lot of Spanish-speaking work in Colombia, I worked with an architectural firm out of suburb of the district. They had a hospital in Ecuador,
mm-hmm.
Ecuador, but Guatemala.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to do the drawings and specifications in Spanish as well as English.
Oh my gosh. Well, and now, in addition to these local projects like hospitals and things, you were starting to, is this when you were doing the prototypes for new cities in Colombia, South America?
That's right. As a matter of fact, I got that job through Larry Koff, and he recommended me for that position, and
mm-hmm.
that was an unusual job. I guess for a first married together, site planning and city planning with landscape architecture.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't architect the landscape, but did prototype for the architecture.
Mm-hmm.
So we tried to do low-cost housing, and a certain percentage had to be upper class in order to have a balanced city.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really a prototype for a new city for the three largest towns or cities in Colombia.
Mm-hmm.
Medellin in the center, Barranquillas on the east coast, and Cali on the west coast. It was the three major cities. And we let Bogota stand on its own,
mm-hmm.
but we did those three. That was not only the prototype and conceptualization, but eventually built.
They did build them.
I kind of lost track of it when it got to that stage.
Why?
And I don't really know. But they, it was highly economic, socialistic, and political
uh-huh.
in nature.
Right.
And that, I kind of got out of it when it got over my head with economics.
Right.
First, exposure to the computer.
Oh, really?
And we did. I was the only landscape architect as a member of the team of top-notch economists and city planners and engineers and every discipline in between, I suppose. Very
so,
much economic.
Right. So a team that's pretty typical these days of that includes landscape architects, right?
Right. Probably the first exposure of landscape architecture into the city planning fabric,
mm-hmm.
and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I've never been back to Colombia in those days, but that was before the cocaine became a national product.
Right.
This was the days when it was a beautiful place, and there was a lot of AID work and Agency for International Development work being given out for hospitals and roads and things like that.
Right. Well, that must have been fascinating. Well, currently you're working as Fraser Consultants International, or FCI. Are you still practicing?
I'm pretty retired now. I say I'm retarded. But most of the FCI, I was blessed by having a partner, my wife, who was not a CPA, but very smart with their computers and the dollar signs.
Right.
And we formed a partnership of the investments, which became our dollar arm for Fraser Consultants International.
Mm-hmm.
So she was the president of the investments, and we were doing work in North Carolina, and particularly in Union County. We inherited some property there that we developed in Cleveland County. We marketed some property.
Mm-hmm.
And still are in business trying to get it off the ground, some of it.
Right.
So Fraser Design International, and it was owned by B Investments, which boils down to two or three or four professionals.
Uh-huh.
And we got into got interested again into the Bucky Fuller concept of a geodesic dome, and tried to promote subdivision using a 36 diameter dome and 50 or so cut down the middle for duplexes.
Hmm.
And we didn't make it at the cut financially, so
mm-hmm.
we didn't see the light of day on that. So the geodome complex, we were just a little too early for it. It's now that area has been developed. And so we were proper in calling it buildable land, but not for us.
Right.
We didn't make the bucks off of it.
Right. Well, Pete, looking back on the landscape architecture field, and based on what you know about it from experience, then looking forward to the landscape architecture profession, what do you see we've learned or not learned, or what can we think about going forward?
I think you're fading out on that last sentence. You repeat the last part of that. What did I think?
What do you think about the profession as we move forward?
Of the what?
Of the landscape architecture profession.
Oh, there you got got a better volume.
Okay.
I kind of dropped out because of my age, and I'm not as active as I used to be on since I retired. I retired from teaching as well, but I think the teaching has, I mean, not teaching, but the landscape architectural profession has improved exponentially. Mm-hmm. It's just very difficult to see how fast from the 50s to the new century the field has moved, and particularly impacts and the need for looking at nature and wetlands and soil and water conservation, and now we're talking about climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And just naturally include landscape architect as a decision maker in some of these naturalistic, some of these developed areas that are in a natural environment.
Mm-hmm.
Like in Louisiana, we have the Mississippi trying to be contained by levees.
Right.
And every once in a while, they overflow, flooding vast tracts of acreage.
Right.
Which has been under the jurisdiction of the Corps of Engineers, specifically for flood control. And when it's not flooding, they use it for agricultural land.
Uh-huh.
But it's designated the Trafalia Flood Control Basin, several hundred thousands of acres.
Mm-hmm.
It goes from the twist up above Baton Rouge all the way to the Gulf.
Right.
And you'll see a big chunk of undeveloped land west of Baton Rouge, west of Lake Charles, before you get to Texas.
Uh-huh.
And that's the Trafalia Basin. Its determinants are natural. Flood and no flood. We have water coming in, partially saline to going to the Gulf, fully saline.
Mm-hmm.
We have some of the best topsoil from Illinois flooding our beautiful Atchafalaya Basin.
Right.
In Puerto Rico, the most expensive item in a budget was topsoil.
Really?
And we had 3 inches of topsoil. Here we have 100 feet of topsoil.
Wow.
Most of the budget in Puerto Rico for topsoil was sand, gravel, rock.
Uh-huh. So you see the landscape architects with a viable role in planning these types of sensitive environments in, or developments in these environmentally sensitive areas?
That I'm going to back up to the 50s when we opened our office. We called ourselves Environmental Design Associates.
Mm-hmm.
Emphasis upon environmental. That was a strange word to be used and had not much of a translation into Spanish.
Uh-huh.
Diseñadores ambientales, that's environmental design. Then gradually, with people like Ekpo and others, and become more accustomed to the environmental desecration of the landscape, you might say, mm-hmm. anarchy that of the 50s suddenly clashed head on with the green movement.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so slowly evened out and become more of a requirement than a luxury. Mm-hmm. And we now have to have not only an environmental impact statement, but it includes an archaeological impact statement as well, and others involving offshore and flood control and impacts of other natures, as you see the British Petroleum blowout that
right.
we had, that worst disaster of an oil rig explosion and its offshoot, that not only eliminated the multi-billion dollar drilling into the core of the earth, not quite that far, but almost,
right,
3,000 feet deep, but it affected the oyster industry, the shellfish industry, the fisheries industry, the nearby states such as Alabama and Florida. I went to Florida for a vacation a couple of years ago and was amazed at the tar balls, B-A-L-L-S.
Really?
Tar balls. The beaches around Destin area, all the way down to Apalachicola, were literally with tar.
Right.
Oil. It was just amazing.
Well, it was certainly well covered in the news media. Is there, as a landscape architect, when you see things like that, do you think of something that you could do from the profession's viewpoint? Is there something that could be said or effort that could be put forward about things like that?
We capitalized back in the 50s using Bucky Fuller and Lewis Clark's philosophy that the landscape is the world, and we invented a logo, my firm did, I did myself personally, land, edge, water. So that triangle starts with land, slope being edge, and water being runoff.
Right.
Be it the Gulf or the deep water. We're diving. I'm a diver as well, as a landscape architect. So I tied together my avocation of being a diving instructor, where we go offshore 6 hours out into the Gulf, 150 miles out maybe, 50 to 150.
Mm-hmm.
The last row of rigs, we hit water clear, as your bathtub water. Mm-hmm. With 150-foot visibility. It's just absolutely beautiful.
Wow.
And we dive on the inside of the ridge. That's so we'll have some protection against sharks particularly, and currents, which are our danger, and the clear water.
Uh-huh.
So we dive inside the rig just like an aquarium. So that's where I got land edge water.
Right.
If I saw the rig as part of our responsibility, where to drill, where not to drill, and how to handle the drilling technology.
Uh-huh.
So that explains because of my diving interest and what I see on the rigs firsthand, we ought to have a say-so in their feasibility.
Right.
That is the impact that they cause. We certainly should stand up and take responsibility, or offer the responsibility.
Right.
Not only that, but the bridges that cross the Mississippi River.
Mm-hmm.
I was appointed by the governor as a member of the study group, Mississippi River Bridge Impact Committee,
uh-huh.
to choose the location for the new river crossing that's now been built.
Uh-huh.
So we had, I was the sole landscape architect amongst many petroleum engineers.
No kidding.
So not only were we interested in highways and impacts of highways, but bridges and its impact of offshore rigs.
Mm-hmm.
Visually impact as well as physically with contaminants.
Right. So so you see a role for landscape architects going forward that's a little bit more involved with setting policy and government oversight than maybe in the past. Is that what I'm hearing?
I'd look towards universalism.
Uh-huh.
Of the landscape architect's contribution being everything.
Uh-huh.
Not something, but everything. In every scale imaginable, we can probably find a role that we can fulfill that other disciplines don't seem to have.
Mm-hmm. That sounds a lot like what I hear Lewis say every now and then.
Correct. So that's what I pioneered, I guess, in Louisiana and also in Puerto Rico.
Right.
And first office was Environmental Design Associate.
Uh-huh.
Oficina de Senadores Ambientales, which in Spanish is Environmental Design Associates.
Mm-hmm. Pete, what's the one important thing to know about Lewis Clark?
What was the first thing?
What is the one important thing to know about Lewis Clark?
He's going to dispute it.
That's true.
I think he's a hell of a nice guy, a good piano player, but sees the world as being one.
Hmm.
And I carried that forward when I was working with my students on doing a university in Nigeria. Unfortunately, we worked with one of our Louisiana, I don't know whether he was senator or a representative, who is fighting in he was indicted, and Jefferson is his name. I enlisted his support, not knowing I picked the wrong man. But we did an interesting university from scratch in Nigeria.
Wow.
For a province called Benin province. And
how do you spell that?
B-E-N-I-G-N, I guess.
Okay.
But I carried that in Haiti, which is the worst environment I guess I've ever seen in terms of sanitation, and in terms of housing deficits, in terms of fresh water.
Right.
It was pathetic, but we did no-cost housing.
Oh.
Which involved what can you do in a landscape fashion for a new community that has no money to build the community? What do you have to have? We needed a sanitation facility, that is, a water faucet and a pit privy.
Right.
Those are two things, plus land for a minimum dwelling. Now, if you've got a pit privy and a water faucet, you can have maybe a minimum dwelling, which would be 13 meters square lot, which would be enough for a bed, but the soil would support a structure 5 stories high.
Oh.
So it has a potential growth.
Right.
To a 5-story apartment, but you start with a water faucet and a pit privy.
Right.
And one tree, that was the part, I insisted upon one tree.
Did you say what kind of tree?
The tree could be justified only on its dollar value.
Oh.
It could be fodder for the animal, which is a goat, and shade for the children. So it, one tree can be economically justified along with a water faucet and a pit privy.
So just those basics. Did they follow through on that yet, or has there been any progress in providing these facilities for people?
We had very good working relations with Egypt in those days, and the new city of Helwan, Egypt, south of Cairo, about an hour's drive. And it was funded by World Bank and various international banks, such as Swiss Bank and International Agency for Development, AID. They were the dollar sponsors because Egypt was what we inherited when the Russians pulled out. And we had very good working relationships with Egypt, but now it's all to naught.
Right.
And I had done work in the Dominican Republic, Haiti, all of the Virgin Islands.
Mm-hmm. So this was for no-cost housing, and you found different markets for your idea. It sounds like it was something that was quite useful.
Right. It married the use of the land with the philosophy of give nature the credit line.
Right.
And the terrible conditions we found in Haiti with water, is rainwater would be in the ditches.
Yeah.
The runoff from the roads, which were paved, some of them, handled the sewage.
Right.
And below the sewage, the ladies would be washing their dishes.
Wow.
And using the water for cooking the rice.
Wow. It's not like your gated go ahead.
That was the cycle, water, sewage,
yeah.
Cooking, back into the ditch again.
Right. So solving, what I'm hearing you say is that you tackled some rough conditions as a landscape architect. It's not like a gated community in the mountains of North Carolina, that's for sure. Pete, let me ask you this. What's the one important thing to know about you?
That I'm a lover, first. And that comes from the heart.
Mm-hmm.
I am a pragmatist. Secondly, so I kind of bend what's practical with my love for what I'm doing is providing housing, providing water, providing a way of life. I picked up a little bit of this when I was in Japan watching the rice sequence from the planting of the rice to the harvesting of the rice and the nurturing of the landscape so it would take the next year's rice.
Right.
It's not plowed under and turned into a shopping center.
Right.
It's turned into a rice field again. So I got that Buddhist philosophy of love of nature.
Uh-huh.
And of course love of womanhood makes me twice the word love has a double meaning, if you know what I mean.
I do. And you played trumpet all these years, too, I think.
Correct.
So you're a trumpet playing lover. I think that that's wonderful for a landscape architect to have those characteristics. Well, Pete, those are all.
Let me add one other.
Okay, I was just going to ask that those are the questions I have. If you'd like to add anything, please do.
Don't forget my love of the water. I'm a diver. And I've taught about 2,500, 3,000 student divers. And each country that I work in, I dive the waters that country has. The caverns of Florida to the caves in Cozumel to the caves in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a diver, a lover of mankind and womankind. practically, I think if it works, it's good economics.
That's great. That's great.
If it doesn't work, it's bad economics. If it's bad to the nature or the site, it's bad economically.
Well, I'm hoping through these interviews with you guys from the 50s and 60s that first started encountering and using ecological and environmentally sound thinking in your designs. I'm hoping by our recording this that we can pass on some of your knowledge.
I hope so too. We see disaster and potential disaster.
Right.
In flooding and offshore oil exploration.
Right.
Onshore, they now want to process oil impregnated sands below the beautiful forest of upper Canada.
Right. Well, the technology is going to get us one way or the other, it sounds like to me. Does it to you, Pete?
Ma'am?
The technology is, if we're not careful, is going to get us one way or the other, isn't it?
Yes. I like the technology that our astronauts put forth. I watch them daily in their newscast. They see the world as one.
Uh-huh. Well, that's just how we're going to have to go forward. And, Pete, I just want to tell you, thank you so much for taking time out for this interview today. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate being asked, and I hope you make some sense out of what I've said. And I want to wish Louis James Clark with an E.
Yes.
Happy birthday coming up.
Yep.
And I won't give away his years, but he's deserves the best that a birthday can offer, not in years, but in recognition.
Right.
And if you look at teaching and the teaching profession, he certainly got a number of disciples out there, and those disciples have given, when they go into teaching, even more disciples, and our profession is growing.
I think so too, and he's very proud of all of you. He's very proud of everything that everybody has done.
Well, bless you, my dear.
Well, thank you, Pete, and I will talk to you again sometime, okay?
I hope to meet you nose to nose, and you just missed Mardi Gras.
I know.
I'll invite you down here for next Mardi Gras.
That sounds great. Okay, Pete, I'll talk to you later. Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.